Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Roy Densaw. I'm a member here, and I usually come on the family teaching sections. So I have been asked as a board member to talk a little bit about giving and generosity and why I contribute to Kadampa Center. And are we online as well? Okay. Can you see me? Okay. Good. So I've been a member here for a while, and I've been thinking about my history of what the Kadampa Center means to me. And one of the things that right off the bat occurred to me is when I started going to teachings in the basement about 15 or so years ago. It's a foreign place. I am not of a tradition that started out practicing Mahayana Buddhism. So coming to this practice, to this symbolism, to the altar, was all new to me. And one of the things that made it accessible is the fact that Kadampa Center, as opposed to a lot of other Buddhist centers, does not charge for classes. Because I think if I would have said, okay, to keep the center going, we have to charge everybody $10 or $15 or whatever it is per class or per session, that would have been an inhibitor. And, you know, over the intervening 15 years, I have noticed that I'm still a little bit uncomfortable. This is still not my background. This is something that I come to very mindfully or approach as an outsider. And I don't think that is necessarily a bad thing. It is just a thing. So coming into this tradition as an outsider makes me mindful of what it does bring into my life and the practices that I try to conduct that will help the ones that are closest to me, my loved ones, and those a little bit farther out, my acquaintances, and then finally the people that I don't know, and hopefully all sentient beings. So the Kadampa Center creates a space that is foreign to most of us, creates Dharma practices that we all find beneficial, and ultimately can benefit not only ourselves, not only our loved ones, not only our people that we don't know, but all sentient beings, which is basically the mission of the Kadampa Center. And as a board member, the board, is focused only on financial matters. We just keep the lights on. We talk about what things cost and the nickels and dimes. So I would like you to consider contributing to the Kadampa Center in one of three ways, not only financially, but also in kind. We have certainly needs for products, and Jill can talk to you about what the needs are of the center to keep it going. Paper towels and different items that we use to keep the center going, but also practices. So the mandala practice of the hand mudra that was taught by Geshe Gelug yesterday at the family teaching is intentional request for practice for Geshe Gelug. Is that correct? One of the four ways to appeal for the annual appeal. So, donations of funds to keep the center going, in-kind participation, paper towels and such, which she will be able to help out with, practices, which is the mandala hand mudra, and I'm missing one, and service, because we have grounds and volunteers. And again, Jill can talk to you about all of the different ways that one can volunteer. So, if you find benefit, like I did in this center, please consider ways to give back, ways to conduct generosity, and I appreciate it. Y'all have a good meeting. Here's Jill.
Thank you, dear. So this pamphlet is out front in the lobby. If you haven't received one in the mail, I guess you guys got yours. And so this has all the information in it. The wish list is in here. And there's loose ones out there for the in-kind donations, the toilet paper, paper towels, soap, all those kind of things. And then the cup. So every year we do a different mug. So this is apparently our Kermit colored year. And so if you do donate in any one of the, you don't have to just do one, all four ways or two out of four ways, then, and you pledge to do that. And that doesn't even mean you have to give right now. So you can just tell the me or send in a form or pop the form. The loose forms are out there too, into the box. You can say, I'd like to pledge this much or this way. Then you can take a mug home tonight. And we have, thank you. So our poster board that we're showing every time is that this is the challenge. Yeah, thank you. The challenges that are offered, I think, though, you have to come. Oh, that's right. This isn't Sunday. We're a little wider spanning. We're not as focused in. So we had four people that stepped up to the plate and gave in various ways to encourage you guys to try to give. And this is above and beyond your regular giving. So if you give $250 a year, then it would have to be above that. So one person gave $5,000, which was amazing, in hopes that three other people would join this person. And this person gave $3,000, and we did get one right here, so in hopes that we get three more. And then one person gave $1,000, and that's your own Gary. That actually fits. Gary Mickey, who's usually here, he gave $1,000. He said we could say his name because, as you've been hearing, he's asked us to empty his wallets. So that if we get one more person to give above their giving at $1,000, he will give another $1,000. So he cut a check to me the night I said, would you be willing to be this person to give $1,000? And he pulled out his checkbook and made me wait, and he wrote the check. I mean, when have you seen that lately? It was really cute. So we're looking for one more person here, and all the 300s, as you heard last week, are rolling in. So many people have given at that level. And then if you enter into this challenge, you will be entered to win a flight to Ocracoke with David Strievel and his wife. And last year, one of the Geshe's went Geshe Song Post. You never know who's going to go along. I think she even brought a friend, Rose won. And then we're looking for someone to also give $150 so they can have a gift certificate to spend there, so they get to buy gifts and buy meals for everybody there. And so that's, if you enter this, you're entered to win that trip. And then Sunday we gave away the tickets to Frida Kahlo. That was fun. I got to call them this morning and tell them. Yes. And then the last one is everybody who enters to the end can win a gift certificate to the Himalayan gift shop. So some of you may know our buddies out there, Nawang and Tenzin. So this is all the appeal that's going on in the fall of every year. So you'll hear these things over and over every time we have one. And that's the scoop. So any way you'd like to donate or work with me, you can call and I'll help you come up with something that you might like to do or offer. Thank you.
Thanks, Jill and Royden. Okay, so just a reminder that this is the last class of Death and Rebirth, so it's the fifth of five classes. But have no fear, the next module is coming up in January. Woohoo! So after tonight, we do have a break on Monday nights, so don't come next week. And we'll pick up on January 6th with Hemant, and he'll be starting the module on establishing a daily practice. And that will run from Monday, January 6th, through Monday, February 10th. And in the meantime, though, this is really cool and very timely. Geshe-la is teaching on Wednesday nights. He does Lamrim topics, and currently he's teaching on the death meditation. Ooh, so that's a good one. So come on Wednesdays. There is no class on Wednesday, December 25th, though. So stay home for that one. Tomorrow, though, if you haven't gotten enough, come tomorrow night from 7 to 8:30. There's a special program on the Nalanda Monastery in France, and this is also starting at 7 o'clock. I think it runs 7 to 8:30, if I'm not mistaken. There's more information online that you can look for that. And then lastly, let me put this stuff down. So as you heard about giving and whatnot, that's always a great way to build your practice of generosity. And so as a small token of our appreciation, and on behalf of Kadampa Center and Discovering Buddhism students, it is my honor to present Steep with a very small token, I guess. I don't really know what's in the envelope, but a small token of our appreciation. So thank you, Steep, for your time and expertise, for sharing your knowledge and insight enthusiasm of the Dharma. It's always a treat. And for making classes like Discovering Buddhism possible. We really do appreciate it. And we're so very fortunate to have this opportunity as students to actually be able to gather here with a teacher in person and to be able to study and learn more and strengthen our understanding of the Dharma. So thank you very much, Deep. Here you go. Thank you.
Don't know is because there's people at home who are watching this, or they will watch the taped version because they can't get here. So this is working, right? All right. So I, you know, most of you know that I lived with Geshe-la for, or Geshe-la lived in my house for 9 years, and and one of the things I wanted to add to the fundraising spiel is something that I don't think Geshe-la would probably talk that much about. I mean, he's told, most people here know that he lived like in a tent for 7 years when he lived in the monastery. He went to the monastery at age 7, separated from his family at that age to go all the way to southern India to kind of the monastery, in the refugee monastery, monastery in exile. Okay, yeah, I can already hear it working. Thank you. And so there was no way for him to see his family for like 3 years. So he's this little guy. And separated from his family, way down in southern India. His parents don't write, so there's no way they can communicate. There's no telephones at the monastery. There's older monks have got all these little monks that to take care of. And so I was talking to him some more about it. I knew that story, and I knew how minimal like the health care was, and you know, like once he was bitten by a rabid dog at the monastery, and he was just lucky that there was a jeep at the monastery to drive him to Mysore, which was like a couple hours away, to get some medical attention. You can still see like these kind of crude stitches that they put in his leg. So he's lots of stories like that. He got typhoid fever, on and on and on. But I hadn't heard this one, and I was asking about his bed, and it was basically made out of bamboo slats that they cut. They cut the bamboo into these slats, and then he was saying, I think what he was describing is they would take the bamboo and kind of crush it up to be like fiber. It would be all connected. So on top of the slats, there's this crunchy, hard bamboo fiber, and on top of that, you put a couple of sheets. And that's what he slept in most of his life at the monastery. So, you know, things were just incredibly difficult. One meal a day, one pair of clothes. He didn't come to the monastery. Some of the monks came from families either that were in the refugee community there or came from families that were better off, and so they would get a lot of, they would get some support in the mail. But when I think about all that he went through to get to where he is and how different his life is in this country, but still how kind of strange it is because he's not with that group that he grew up with. He's here with us, but the conditions are much better. Anyway, it always inspires my practice to know what he went through as a kid and still, you know, to keep on studying and memorizing and doing all that he did to pass the Geshe exams and come to this country. So what we're doing when we contribute to the center is we are preserving the Buddha teachings. And so the odds of us being in this city that have a teacher like Geshe-la is just phenomenal. So that's a whole meditation on itself. So, now on to the death meditations. This is the last class in the module, so we're going to go through some of the meditations. And the first thing we always do in Buddhist practices is to start with setting our intention. And so to bring our awareness to why we came here tonight, you know, even on the most mundane level, you know, came here out of interest, curiosity, to try to learn more. And then we try to grow that motivation to understand, to expand it. So, for example, understanding death becoming familiar with it so it's not so fearful to us. So that as someone studying Buddhism, we understand that we can use each moment in our life and in our death to expand our consciousness to the greatest degree possible, complete and utter enlightenment, so that that state that we are in then would be of benefit to other beings. And so with that in mind, we set our intention for tonight that what we're going to be practicing and talking about and meditating on will contribute to that highest goal that we are starting here today with. And I'm going to lead us through a meditation. So check your posture. You know, where if you're sitting in a chair, make sure your feet are flat on the floor. Check your spine. Tuck your chin so that the top of your spine is as straight as possible. Have your arms out away from your body so they don't impede your breathing. You can open or close your eyes, but I've read that it's helpful to try to have a little bit of light coming in, so there's not this complete duality of open and closed eyes, that our brain doesn't get tricked into only going into these meditative states or these deeper awareness and knowledge with eyes closed. But we're not also focusing on something specifically. It's just enough light to keep us alert. And then for a few minutes, bring all of your attention to your breath, the sensation of air coming in and out of your nostrils, or the feeling of your abdomen expanding and contracting. And just pick one sensation and use one full inhalation, exhalation as one. And the next one is two, so that you're tying your thoughts to the count. You can count up to 5 or 10 and then start over again. But it's to serve as a leash, because your mind is going to want to wander all over the place. And as you're bringing it back over and over again, you're strengthening the muscle of focus so that your mind can do two things. One, develop stronger muscles of single-pointed concentration, and also get a break. Our minds are like toddlers running all over the place. So if we can learn to rest in between all of those thoughts, our mind actually relaxes and becomes a relaxed alertness. And it's with that relaxed, alert focus that we can then aim that concentration on analytical topics in meditation. So just count your breaths for a while, and then I will lead us through the death awareness meditation. I'm going to lead us through the 9-point meditation on death that we've been practicing. It's meant to help us use death in our lives to empower us, to empower our actions, so that our life is as meaningful as possible. Just keep that in mind. If any time when you're meditating on these topics, fear arises, know that the point is to be empowered, not fearful. So the first category, which has three subparts, is the inevitability of death. We plan many activities and projects for the coming days and years. And although death is the only event that is certain to occur, we don't usually think about or plan for it. We usually push it away. But it's important to think about and be prepared for so we can use it. Contemplate the following 3 points to get a sense of how death is definitely going to come. 1, everyone has to die. Bring to mind people from the past, famous people, ordinary people, scientists, saints, criminals. These people were once alive. They worked, thought and wrote, they loved and fought, enjoyed and suffered, and finally died. Can you think of any exception? Bring to mind people you know who have already died. Think of the people you know who are still alive. Our deaths are the one thing we all have in common. There are several billion people on the planet right now, but 100 years from now, all of these people, with the exception of a few who are very young and may live to be very old, will be gone, including yourself. Try to experience this fact with your entire being. The second point is your lifespan is decreasing continuously. Time never stands still. Seconds become minutes, become hours, become days, years, and as time is passing in this way, you are traveling closer and closer towards death. Like an hourglass with sand running into the bottom. Another way to get a sense of your life moving continuously towards death is to imagine being on a train which is always traveling at a steady speed. It never slows down or stops. There's no way to get off. This train is continuously bringing you closer and closer to its destination. Try to get a sense of this and check what thoughts and feelings arise in your mind. third point is the amount of time you have for spiritual practice is very small. Since you are getting closer to death all the time, what are you doing to prepare for it? The best way to prepare is doing spiritual practice. That is because the only thing that continues after death is the mind, and spiritual practice is the only thing that truly benefits the mind. Preparing it for death and the journey to the next life. But how much time do you actually devote to this practice? Do you devote to working on decreasing the negative aspects of the mind and developing the positive aspects, such as kindness and wisdom? How much time do you devote to behaving in ways that are beneficial to others? Calculate the time you spent in an average day sleeping, working, preparing food, socializing. How much time do you spend feeling frustrated, bored, resentful, jealous, lazy, critical? And how much time do you spend consciously trying to improve your state of mind or doing beneficial things such as helping others or spiritual study? Assessing your life in this practical way helps you see clearly how much time is spent doing things that benefit yourself and others, that will be helpful for your mind at the time of death and in the next life. So by meditating on these first three points, this helps us develop the determination to use our lives wisely and mindfully. The second category is the uncertainty of the time of death. The first three points help us accept that we're definitely going to die. But we might think that death is not going to happen for a long time. Why? Is there any way you can know for sure when death will happen? We use these meditations when we need help understanding the uncertainty and unpredictability of the time of death to help us with our practice. So the first point in this category is that human life expectancy is uncertain. If human beings died at a specific age, say 88, we would have plenty of time and space to prepare. But there is no certainty. Death catches most of us by surprise. Life can end at any point: birth, in childhood, adolescence, age 22, 35, 50, 94. Think of examples of people you know or have heard about who died before they reached the age you are now. Being young and healthy is no guarantee of a long life. Sometimes it's very difficult to feel convinced that death could happen at any moment. But thousands of people die every day and few of them expect it. So generate a strong feeling of the complete uncertainty of your own time of death, how there is simply no guarantee that you have long to live. The second point, there are many causes of death. There are many different ways that death can happen to people. Sometimes death happens due to external causes, natural disasters, floods, volcanoes, accidents such as car accidents, plane crashes. People can be killed by other people, or animals, poisonous insects. Death can also happen due to internal causes. There are hundreds of different diseases that can rob us of health and lead to death. There are also cases of people who are not ill, but their bodies simply stop functioning and they suddenly die. Even things which normally support life can become the cause of death. Food, for example, which we need in order to stay alive, can lead to death. If we choke on it, if the food is contaminated, medicine is another thing which normally supports life, but sometimes people die because they took the wrong medicine or the wrong dose. Houses can catch fire or collapse, killing the people inside. Bring to mind cases of people you know or have heard about who have died and how they have died. Think that any of these things could also happen to you. And the third point in this category is the human body is very fragile. It can be injured or struck down by illness so easily. Within minutes, it can change from being strong and active to being helplessly weak and full of pain. Something as small as a virus or as insignificant as a thorn can become the cause of your death. Recall the times you have hurt or injured your body and how easily it could happen again and even cause your death. Your body will not last forever. You have managed to avoid illnesses and accidents, but the years will eventually overtake you. Your body will lose its beauty and vitality and finally die. By meditating on these second three points, we develop the determination to begin our practice of the spiritual path now, as the future is so uncertain. And the final point is, final category is the fact that only spiritual practice can help at the time of death. No matter how much we have acquired or developed throughout our life, in terms of family, friends, wealth, power, travel experiences, and so on, none of it goes with us at death. Only our mind continues, carrying imprints of all that we have thought, felt, said, and done. If you acquired the most wealth of anyone on this planet, none of it would follow you. Only the imprints of things you have thought, felt, said, or done, these follow you. It is vital that when we die, we will have as many positive imprints, which will bring good experiences, and as few negative imprints, which will bring suffering, on our mind as possible. We should aim to die at peace with ourselves, feeling good about how we lived our life, and not leaving behind unresolved conflicts. The only things that will truly benefit us at the time of death are positive states of mind. A calm acceptance of the changes that are taking place, compassion, patience, wisdom. In order to be able to have these states of mind at the time of death, we need to make ourselves familiar with them during the course of our lives. This is the essence of Dharma or spiritual practice. And this practice can be done throughout the entire day. Realizing this will give us the incentive and energy to start practicing now with as much time that we have. You can experience a strong feeling of this reality by imagining yourself at the time of death and contemplating the following 3 points. That your loved ones cannot help you at that point. As you lie on your deathbed, or as the plane you're traveling in is going to crash, what kind of thoughts come to your mind? Our strongest attachments are usually to our family and friends, so you probably think of them and feel a strong wish to be with them. But even if they were present, would they be able to help you? Although they love you very much and do not want you to die, they cannot prevent it from happening. Sometimes they can help remind you of the most important things to think about, how to stay calm. Other times, family can stir up emotions in our mind, our sadness or worry. When we die, no one, not even our closest loved one, can accompany us. Being able to accept this and let go of our attachment will cause our mind, being unable to accept this will cause our mind to be in turmoil and make it very difficult to have a peaceful death. See if you can realize that having a strong clinging to people can be an obstacle to a peaceful state of mind at the time of death. What will allow you to decrease that clinging? And feel peaceful. The second point is that your possessions and enjoyments cannot help you. Sometimes the mind thinks of the possessions and property it has accumulated, since this occupied a great deal of time while we are alive and created pleasure or conflicts or satisfaction, but none of these things can bring comfort and peace at the time of death. Your wealth may be able to provide you with a private room in the hospital and excellent medical care, but that is all it can do. It cannot stop what is happening, and you cannot take it with you, not even a penny. Our possessions can't help us at the time of death, but sometimes they create obstacles with worry about them. Who will get what? And whether or not they'll take proper care of your things. So that makes it difficult to have a peaceful, detached state of mind at the time of death. Contemplate these points and see if you can understand the importance of learning to be less dependent and grasping to material things. The final point is your own body cannot help. Your body has been your constant companion since birth. You know it more intimately than anything or anyone else. You have cared for it and protected it, worried about it, kept it comfortable and healthy as you should, fed it and cleaned it, experienced all kinds of pleasure and pain with it. It's been a treasured possession. But now you are dying, and that means you will be separated from it. it will become weak and eventually useless. Your mind will separate from it, and it will be taken away. What good can it possibly do you now? Fear of pain and regret about leaving your body will only exaggerate your suffering. So by meditating on these three final points, we come to realize how important it is to work on reducing our clinging to the things of this life, learning to hold them, but hold them lightly, learning to understand that the world goes away. What's important is to take care of our mind. This is the only thing that will continue in the next life. As the imprints of our action in this life will also go with our mind to the next one and will determine the kind of rebirth and experiences we'll have. It is essential to try our best to refrain from negative actions and create positive actions as much as possible. Check in and see what kind of feelings this meditation may have stirred up, so that you can work on being prepared for death when it does happen. Being afraid of death isn't helpful. What is helpful is to be afraid of dying with a negative state of mind and a lot of imprints from negative actions. This motivates us to create more positive actions and to practice. If we keep death in mind in an easy, open way, this clinging will gradually loosen, allowing us to be mindful and make every action positive and beneficial for ourselves and others. An awareness of death gives us enormous energy to not waste our life, to see every opportunity as rich with potential. So then in bringing this meditation to a close, try to generate this optimistic thought that you have every possibility, enormous opportunities to make your life meaningful, beneficial, and positive. Even in the moment it takes to light a stick of incense, you can create so much positive merit. And in this way, you will be able to die with peace of mind. Okay. And slowly open your eyes when you're ready. So that was a long version of the meditation we've been working on since the beginning. I've been reading about how sometimes people take each of these points and just do one session on each one. So we went through all of them. Any thoughts that came up throughout it? Anything, any questions or comments or things where you get stuck?
Steve, I did have something right here. But you kind of just addressed it. I was thinking, how are we supposed to do all these practices? And I like the what you just said, just mm-hmm. take one point or
right.
know, one section. Yeah.
Right.
Rather than trying to do the whole thing.
Yeah, and, you know, this is kind of this evolution, because in the beginning it's talking about, you know, how little time there is. There's no time for practice, that whole meditation. But it moves through to where every single thing we do can be rich. It doesn't have to be that you have to get away from you. It's not that you can't do these things at work. It's not that you have to carve out this time where you're sitting on a cushion and doing it in this specific way. That everything we do can be so rich with this positive mind state that is being described here that we are trying to generate. If the whole point is to have as many positive imprints as possible, every single thing we're doing can create those. So that's what also gives me a lot of hope. So we're meditating on how little time we've actually spent practicing, and it lists all these things of cooking and blah, 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 blah. But each one of those things can be hugely beneficial. So I think I've talked to you all about, like, when the monks were first here years ago on this tour, and they all stayed in my house. I'd take them to, like, Harris Teeter. They'd never been in a grocery store like Harris Teeter, and they were just, you know, taking pictures of each other. And I asked them what they were doing at one point. Well, they were mentally offering all the food to all the beings in the world. That prayer alone, even though, because I used to think, really? You can't give it to everybody. But if you have the wish that you could share this, then you're not just consuming it yourself. You're working on your mind. That's the whole point. And so, you know, I used to just hound Geshe-la with a gazillion questions all the time. And because I can't do something unless it really makes sense to me and it really sticks. So I used to wonder all the time, like, what's the point of prayer? I don't get it, you know. And he and this other teacher said to me, the point of prayer is to make your mind and the prayer the same thing. It's not that some magic happens, you know, and, you know, like the way that we in the West kind of, this whole thing of Santa Claus. It's not like that. It's that the point is that you and the prayer, your mind becomes the same thing. So when you're wishing for other people and other beings to have some of the things that you have, that's changing your mind. It's changing our mind of the way that we hold things. If we don't have to give away everything that we have, it's about being more generous internally and externally. So I remember for a while I was really, really focused on that. I have to get back to that. Where, like, every night when I got into bed, I'd think how amazing it is that I have a bed. When I think about Geshe-la sleeping on those bamboo slats, how amazing it is, no matter where I am, I always have a roof over my head and I have a bed and a blanket, even when I'm borrowing them. So how amazing is that? And then I just wish that everybody had that. So the point, again, is to work with our minds. Our minds can create so many positive things. We tend to think of just the physical things that we can do. And so that's why it's important to remember the three gates, the three ways that we create positive action and negative action is through our body, our speech, and our mind. And our mind is the one that's the easiest. Like, just as you open the door, you can make a wish that you could open the door out of the prison of samsara for all beings. So anything. So that's something that at the end I try to remember, that what the point is to remember that you have opportunities constantly to create this positive merit. Also, you know, and I said this in the beginning, you know yourself. You know which meditations you need and don't need. I don't have very hard time generating the fact that I'll die. I just don't have a hard time generating that awareness. Some people really do. The first class, remember, I think Lori was saying that that's something she struggles with the urgency of and the reality of death. And so she needs more meditations on that. I, on the other hand, have way too strong a sense that I could die. And so what I need to work with more is the familiarization of the death dissolution states. And that's what brought me to Buddhism, was because that then calmed down some of the other awareness, the hyper-awareness I have of my own death. So you know which ones you need more, and so find the right balance for you and work with that. And some days it'll be different. So you'll, if you come on Wednesday night, you'll hear Geshe-la talking about the five aggregates. So I just thought I should review that, because when we go through the death dissolution meditation, which I'll do in a minute, and we did quite a bit last week, what's dissolving, you know, are the elements in the body and what we call the aggregates. So it just means that there are things that come together to form this life that you, that is labeled whatever your name is. Okay, so, you know, if I lost, it's an interesting meditation to go through and take away some things. Could you still have the label of you? You know, what is it that supports this life that's created, that's called you? The five aggregates, you know, you'll hear them called different things in different teachings, but I've written up them up there, and I have a couple different things I can talk to you about. But form is really the physical form, the physical world. And when we go through the death dissolution states, obviously each one of those things is dissolving. Different parts of the physical form is dissolving. The physical factors, it's the material. It includes our bodies and also material objects as well. Specifically, the form includes the five physical organs, eye, ears, nose, tongue, body, and the sense organs, sight, sound, smell, taste, and tangible objects. Then sensation. And this, in Buddhist, in this practice, it's really three things. It's the three feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and indifferent. So pain, pleasure, and neutrality. That's the sensation. It's just really kind of raw, primitive. Do I like this? Does it hurt? Is it neutral? The third one is perception. And again, it's not perception in the ordinary English as much as recognition or interpretation of sense objects, followed by labeling. So the recognition of things and what we call them. So in the death dissolution that we did last week, remember when I was saying, like, you can no longer remember the names of the people around you. That part of perception is dissolving. You know, this is exactly why we're going over this, because in the death dissolution process, each one of these things is dissolving. So in the second stage, you no longer feel pain, pleasure, neutrality. You no longer remember them. So that's the good news. If you're in pain when you're dying, by the time you get to the second stage, you won't be in pain. So I remember taking a great deal of pleasure of like, oh, good. But, you know, I also don't remember them. It's just that whole part of you is gone. Then the third step when we go through it is you don't remember the names of the people around you or in your life. You don't remember, then you don't remember the relationships at all. All of that has dissolved. So that's what perception is, being able to recognize and label things and objects. The fourth is mental formations. And this is a little bit different. This is, I've heard it described different ways, but it's more the mental form. I'll just read this to you. The mental formation may be described as a conditioned response to the object of experience. It is not just the impression created by previous actions, but also the responses here and how and now motivated and directed in a particular way. In short, mental formation or volition has moral dimension. Perception has conceptual dimension. Feeling has emotional dimension. So what I've heard about mental formation, it's more like when you decide to do something. Volition. They gave a really good example in this one thing I found. It's kind of like the reaction to something. The mind catches up with the experience. I don't know. It was kind of like they were described, they had some story about the mind catches up with experience and applies a label to it. So for an example, we hear a sound, a car's backfiring. We hear a sound, that sensation. We dislike it, that's feeling. And we leap to our feet before we realize the car is backfiring. The leaping to our feet is the fourth one, the mental formation. It's like the reaction to something. That's as good as I can get right now. The fifth one is consciousness dissolves. That includes, consciousness is a big category. It includes thoughts, but also sensitivities, there's all different levels of different consciousness, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, all of these things, mind consciousness. All of these, so the very last thing to dissolve is the consciousness. And that's when, you know, in the death dissolution, the last thing you see is this kind of light, and then there's these different colors, and then there's this fainting sensation, right? And then we talk about the clear light arising. And at that point, if you have any understanding of emptiness, try to join that understanding of emptiness with the emptiness that is arising in your mind. It's very complicated. But it's easier to experience in meditation when we go through those death dissolution states. So everything else that's distracting us, that is, we get down to that very, very subtle mind. So all of the mind states that we're talking about and using right now, those start to dissolve. And what arises then is that most subtle mind state, which we try to tap into when we're meditating on emptiness. And so when that mind state has arisen, we try to join it. It's what they call the mother and child light joining. And so if a great practitioner who's really meditated and understood emptiness can stay in that state for quite a long period of time before the mind moves on to the bardo state where they're going to take rebirth. So we practice it in our meditations, and it also helps just increase our comfort with the death dissolution process. The whole point, as I talked about last week, is to become familiar with these states so that the process isn't frightening to us. You know, it's like if we understand reincarnation, we have gone through this process countless times. We just don't remember it. Just like we probably don't remember actually falling asleep last night. We remember getting in bed. We remember waking up in the middle of the night to go pee. But we don't remember that moment that we actually changed into this state of sleep. So this helps my mind, at any rate, to know that I've died zillions of times, and that if I can, you know, use this moment of death to try to direct my consciousness, and to that's the whole point. That's the whole point of the evolution that I'm going through. So, what are some of the things that get in your way of having a calm, what do you think would either get in your way of having a calm death, or what are the things now that get in your way when you think about it?
People?
Yes. Say a little bit more.
I'm okay with it,
mm-hmm.
but I'm afraid the people around me are going to
be upset.
Yes.
Okay.
And say things to redirect my mind.
Mhm. Yeah. And do other people have that same fear? Yeah. Are there things that you can do about it now, do you think? And things that you can tell them?
I do.
Okay.
I subtly say little things
mm-hmm.
about death.
Mhm.
My mother's 97.
Wow.
And she does not like the word death at
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
But I slowly bring it into mm-hmm. sentences, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, like calmly and easily.
Mm-hmm. Is it the idea that she doesn't like or that actual word?
The idea.
The idea.
Or the word is frightening to her. She's talked herself into believing mm-hmm. things that, you know, that is frightening. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I talk about it calmly
mm-hmm.
and let her know how it's okay,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And so that's in this other topic, too, of how do we help other people yes. when they're dying,
yes.
you know, and then talking to people about how to help us when yes. we're dying,
yes.
you know. And luckily for us, too, right now, you know, in this time, there's a lot of information from hospice, you know, and when my mom was dying, hospice did an amazing job honoring our wishes for her death. And I think that that whole movement, the hospice movement, can help us have that conversation with people around us that, you know, I told her, you know, my mother had dementia, so it was, I don't really know what she was experiencing, but I told the hospice workers I wanted my mother to have as good a death as possible. And that's what they're all about. And so what's a good death, what's involved, that's what they wanted to know. What's involved in that for us, for our kind of beliefs? And it might be helpful to use some of that language with people around you that, you know, this is what I want at the moment of death. This is what's going to keep me calm, you know, and this is what I need. Can you do these things?
I have siblings that will probably spaz out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I constantly try to think of ways to deal with that.
Yeah. You know, and some is like sometimes culturally we feel that we should be expressing ourselves in a certain way at somebody's deathbed. That this is how we should be expressing ourselves. That's what we're feeling, and we think it will help them. And if we slowly can start to educate people around us that that's not actually going to be helpful. And that if you're feeling those things, here's another place to go and do it. But around me, this is what I need, you know. So I knew this woman at the center a long time ago who used to try to help people come up with very clear things that they could write for their families to see so that just instructions. You know, this is what I would need, this is what I would like to have. Sometimes people are more willing to, they know that it's not an easy thing for anybody, and so they're more willing, it seems, to follow some of those wishes, you know, than if it was just something else going on in your life. So I just encourage you to keep on doing what you're doing, which is trying to find ways to express to people around you what you need. You know, it's your life, it's your death, this is what I would like to have happen. And maybe other people here can also talk to you afterwards about what they have done. But I think it's a huge issue, yeah. Anything else that gets in people's craw, yeah.
Physical pain.
Yeah.
Intense physical pain. It really disables mental capability, even to meditate.
Right.
So it's a vicious downward spiral.
Right.
Can be.
Yeah. Yeah, and so the fear of intense physical pain at the time of death?
Not so much. Not fear.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I've had intense physical pain at numerous points in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what it's like. And I know what I will be what I'm capable of. I mean, in terms of mentally,
right?
You know, how much can I meditate?
Right.
You know, how can I meditate on emptiness when?
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
And it's. I don't feel a fear, but there's, you know, the possibility of that,
mm-hmm.
and it's. It's just a concern.
Right.
I wonder what if, and the only solutions to pain that intense kind of pain that I've come across or that's been presented to me are some form of opiate.
Right.
And then that just brings you right down.
Right. Well, I can share this story. I mean, I think I know for me, if I'm going to be in that intense physical pain, I'll take the opiate just because it's, I think it's a pretty good choice at that point. I hope Geshe-la doesn't mind me telling this story. He was in intense physical pain at one point. This is years ago. I had to call an ambulance, and they gave him morphine for it. I mean, it was really, really intense. And he'd never had anything like this. We were in the hospital, and, you know, he was sitting in a wheelchair. His head was bobbing all over the place, and I stood behind him so his head wouldn't just keep bobbing back, you know, so he could lean his head against my stomach. And then finally he kind of came out of me. He goes, "I feel really weird." I said, "Oh, it's the drugs." but I had never seen him in that kind of pain, and he had like some grit left from the pancreas. He was pancreatitis is what he was having, you know, which could have killed him. And so later when we were talking about this, you know, weeks later after he recovered, he said, "Yeah, the mind can't do anything in that kind of pain. It was, you know, just debilitating, excruciating pain." And he was grateful for the drugs, you know, to get him through that. And if the pain is like, and it's funny because just before that, we were in the doctor's office and I was showing him the chart because I thought one day he may need to know this if somebody asks you about your pain scale on a scale of 1 to 10. He was like, "Oh, that's Western. I don't need that." And I was like, "Oh, I'm just saying if somebody ever asks you, that's what it is. It's your own pain scale." So sure enough, when they were putting him in the ambulance, they were like, "What's your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? He was like, "10! And so I'm so glad I told him that, like 1 week before that. And so that's when I, you know, gave him this morphine, and he was very grateful for it because it relieved the pain enough that he could then start using his mind enough. He wasn't completely out of it in the morphine. And for a while I think he was, but then he came to this state where he was pain-free and just kind of floating, and that's when he could then kind of use it. We all know that state. Then he could kind of use his mind again, and then afterwards he was saying, "Yeah, there's just no way. There's just no way you can do anything. It's like if you've been bitten by a rabid dog and the dog's teeth are in you, you can try not to kill the dog, but you're going to get away from that pain, you know." So I think that there's things that we can do, maybe there's things that maybe we can do as much as possible with that. But thank goodness for pain medication. That's all I can say, you know. Yeah.
Is there a karmic thing that brings the pain?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure. There's no use. I mean, there's karmic things that bring us every single thing, right? We also have the karma to be in a country that has drugs that can help us get out of the pain. And I know in hospice, they're working so that you can... I mean, one of the things I saw with my mom is they wanted to give her morphine as soon as she started the stages of dying because of the restlessness in the first stage, which is we're going to go through that first stage where you feel like your arms and legs are falling. You'll see a lot of people trying to get out of bed. When my dog was dying, she was constantly trying to get up, and Geshe-la was saying that's the first stage where it feels like you're falling. If you're aware of it, you might not be as restless. But again, my mom had dementia. There's no way. So they gave her morphine just to, I don't know if it helped her or if it helped us, but they gave her the smallest amount possible every like 5 hours to keep her calm. I'm not really answering your question, except that yes, of course there is. So it's to me less about trying to figure that out as to work with what's in front of me. You know, because there's just so much karma, right? And the way I look at karma is, you know, when I do the King of Prayers and the confession, I am confessing for every kind of wrongdoing I can ever think possible. I don't have any memory of doing those things, but we've all done them. If we're all human, you know, we're all sentient beings, we've committed all these things in some life or another. That's one way to look at it. So I don't get too tripped up over that because it just brings... In my mind, it just brings judgment. It doesn't help. it doesn't help get me out of the pain.
Yeah, personally, I face a lot of that pain thing.
Right.
Repeated. So I don't understand why it keeps happening. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so here, this is kind of a good segue into something that I think is important for us to have peaceful deaths, is to have less regret, right? So we come into this life with little packages of karma. Who knows where they come from? It's not really going to help if I go back and look at, like, if I knew all my past lives and what happened in those. I don't know that that's going to help me. What's going to help me is to use this moment, and I'm the keeper of the consciousness now. And I'm the one who's born with all this incredible opportunity and a mind that and an opportunity to study Dharma to do something about it. So I can try to clean up my river of consciousness as much as possible now that I'm in control of this life, right? So that means just, there's all kinds of ways to do purification practice, right? All kinds of things. Just walking around the stupa, just saying a simple prayer. There's all kinds of things. So the other thing that we can do is try not to create more actions that we regret. That's the biggest opportunity we have right now, is not to create things so that at the moment of dying, we're regretful. And I remember I used to always hear this, that people have all these regrets at the time of their death. And I didn't really get it until I saw it, until I saw, like, my uncles who would be high on painkillers, laying in a hospital bed, telling me all kinds of things. And I was like, wow. You know, I saw things that they regretted from their 20s that all of a sudden they hadn't thought about until now they're in their 80s. And then this is all coming out. So I thought, oh, it's really good that I start thinking about those things now so that I'm not just thinking about them 2 hours before I die. So that, I think, is a huge chance now, is to look at the things that we regret, feel like we've cleaned them up enough so that they're not going to haunt us at the moment of our death. So we feel like, you know what, I've done as much as I can do in this life. I feel good about what I've done. So whatever purification practices work for you, even if it's like as simple as what I've said before, like you're sweeping the floor, and in your mind you create a very strong intention, I am cleaning away all of whatever misdeed or whatever thing you regret, I'm cleaning this up. This is purification practice, so that you feel like it's I regret it, I'm not going to do it again, I'm applying the remedy, now it's done, and I can move on. So I want to show, because we don't have much time. Yeah. How long is that clip, Brian? It's like 3 minutes? Okay. So I always like to do something fun in the last class. So we're going to show this in a minute. It's just a fun way to think about purification. It's a very mundane, modern-day example, but it's kind of fun. And you may have seen this before. And then we'll finish by doing the death dissolution meditation. And then if you want more in depth, come on Wednesday night and hear Geshe-la talk. So this is a true story in California, and I think we'll talk later about how to apply it to our own lives. Oh, maybe not. Well, while Brian's doing that, so to me, the things that kind of get in the way, we've talked about pain, other people, the whole point is, how can we have as calm a mind as possible, kind of ready, know that it could come at any time, you never know when you're going to get called up. So I try to use different things in my own life to remind myself of that. I also think that impermanence, you know, that we've talked before about how we can kind of get focused on the negative part of impermanence, but also reminding ourselves of the positive part of impermanence. So like when I used to visit my mom the last couple of months, she was in this nursing home, and it was pretty gruesome going in there every day. And I would try to, like, remind myself not to be fooled by my eyes. You know, like if a Martian landed on this earth and he saw a woman giving birth, and he didn't know what was coming, he would just see this woman in excruciating pain. And he would go back to his planet and say, oh, my God. You know? But if that Martian knew what was coming around the corner, it would be just like the woman giving birth. She knows that this life is coming in. So it's a very different experience. So that's what I would always try to think of, like these people in the nursing home, they're kind of in labor. You know, something else is coming. We just don't see it. So all we see is this down, this part of impermanence, and go, oh my God, I hope this doesn't happen to me, or blah, blah, blah. But meanwhile, it may not work. Okay, well, then I can just describe it. It'll be really a very pale example. Oh my God. But so trying to find things in our life, because we don't have little movie clips, we don't have a trailer of coming attractions that we can use for what we're hoping is our next life, right? What we're hoping to be able to experience. But we need to keep finding ways of looking at things, looking at the more positive parts of impermanence, that just as things dissolve, so do things arise. So this clip, if you Google, what's the name of it, Brian?
Buddha of Oakland.
Buddha of Oakland. If you Google Buddha of Oakland, what it is this really cool story about this guy lived in kind of this rundown neighborhood in Oakland, and there was this little, you know, like those islands in the middle of a street, you know, it was like a little island where people would throw trash all the time. He said, because it was a big enough island, like maybe a quarter size of this room, and people would dump mattresses there and beer cans, and it was just getting fights there and everything, and he was getting sick of it. So what he decided to do, he wasn't Buddhist, but he found this really nice Buddhist statue, and he thought, maybe if I put a statue there, nobody's going to throw their trash there anymore. So he put this little concrete Buddha statue there. And what he didn't know is the results that would happen, that there were some Vietnamese in the neighborhood who saw this and started making offerings every morning. They would put some oranges there, a candle there, and nobody was throwing trash. And then sooner or later, somebody built a little hut around, a little shrine around the Buddha, and then they built it up, and then then planted flowers, and the whole thing grew. Now people would fly from all around the world to go and see the Buddha of Oakland. And so what it to me is like this really kind of fun example of purification. So where in your life is the island of garbage? I mean, the way I look at it is, where is the part in us that we don't treat well, that we don't feel good about ourselves, that we don't look at, or we trash, or we just, you know, the part of ourselves that we don't like very much and we don't take care of? And if we put something beautiful in that place instead, it'll attract more beauty. It'll attract us taking care of that part of ourselves better. That's one way to look at it. I know parts of myself that I neglected because I didn't like parts of my history or parts of my personality. And instead, if I tended to it, you know, pulled the weeds out, looked at it better, it's the same thing as that story. That's just a very mundane, concrete example. And I'm now talking about doing it on the inside. It will start to attract more of your own care, and it can become a really holy spot. You can turn crap into something gorgeous and beautiful and honorable and something that actually helps people. And so now every year this whole community comes to this guy's house and bring him offerings. He's like, guys, I just put a statue there. But they are so grateful to him. And so to me it's just a really lovely example. So feeling that about ourselves, that, you know, I cleaned up something in this life. I cleaned up this thing that was handed to me that was really difficult. I did as much as I could in this life to clean it up. Feeling that, okay, you know, I might not be able, this is what got me into Buddhism. I might not be able to have the death that I want. You know, that's what really freaked me out, is I thought, what am I going to do if someone kills me? I won't be able to die in this way and have all of this. But I felt like, well, you know, I can still, at that moment of death, try to have a calm mind. You know, I told you my example of when I understood how Gandhi died, that he was able to do that because of his practice, because of his mind, because of his constant awareness of death coming. I didn't have time today, but you can look it up in our material called The Five Powers to be Practiced at the Time of Death. And a lot of them are about intention and awareness and bodhicitta And even if you were at the moment of your death, like we were talking before about, what if you see a car coming at you and it's about to hit you? In that moment, if you even think of bodhicitta, that might be the way that your mind is directed then, even though you're dying the sudden kind of violent death. I was telling Geshe-la how I watched this thing, I don't remember, some TV show years ago, where this is how a woman thought she was about to die. This truck was coming right at her. And the moment before the truck hit, she said she saw this like golden man, like this beautiful angel. And then she went unconscious. And so she was in the hospital for days. And then when she was coming to her back to consciousness, her son was there, and she was kind of waking up, and she was asking him about the man. And he thought she was talking about the driver. And he said, oh, we got him, Mom, he's in jail. And she's like, what? She was thinking about this being she saw. And she was trying to describe it to people, and they had all just thought it was the drug she was on. So I was asking Geshe-la about them. He said, yeah, it could have been, you know, some holy being that she already had some kind of connection with at that moment of death. That's what she saw. So even though somebody has a sudden violent death, that was her experience rather than what we saw. It's a perfect example of how our eyes are different than what somebody else's experience is. So practicing being able to recall bodhicitta throughout the day, one of the things I try to do all day long is ask myself, is this a dream? And that carries over then into my dream. Sometimes in the middle of my dream, I'm like, wait a minute, I think this is a dream. And I start saying a mantra. I start flying. I just doing all kinds of things. So if it's possible to do that in a dream, it's possible to do that at the moment of death, it's possible to do it in the bardo. We have all this time, right this minute, right in this last hour and a half, we've had all this time to think and practice about it. That's huge. So as Geshe-la would say, think about how many other people on Monday night are thinking and practicing this topic in North Carolina right now. Not many. So all the positive merit that you've created by coming here on a Monday night, tonight or in the other nights, and by thinking about this topic, meditating on it, that's incredibly positive merit that you've created in this very little amount of time. So now the point is to dedicate it. We set our intention, we practiced, we thought about this, shared with other people. Take a moment to dedicate this merit. It's like positive seeds that will definitely grow somewhere. And you have the ability to direct where that's going to grow. You can direct it to removing all obstacles between you and complete enlightenment, so that you can achieve that enlightened state as quickly as possible for your benefit and the benefit of all others. I thank you very much.